For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
The chapter in front of us, as I was thinking about this class this week, I realized, it's just called Holiness, the Jew Sanctifies the Physical. It's chapter 5. So this chapter, I realized, is when I read it 20 years ago, 19 years ago to be specific, it had a very, very profound impact on my life. And I'll get back to that, I hope. But I would also add that to the degree that I have had an influence on the affairs of this shul, and I've had some influence on the affairs of the shul, it also has had a profound impact on the mission and messages of the shul, of the talks and classes, etc. There's no topic about which we have spoken more than the topic of holiness as defined in this chapter. And I don't think there is a close second. I know for sure there is no close second. So now that said, I printed something that I wrote on the same topic, basically, that I think you'll see, since the rabbi positions that this is the central theme of Judaism, you'll see how even in a different article in which I actually quote him from this chapter, you'll see how central this is. So this is entitled, "This is None Other Than the Abode of God, and This is the Gate of the Heavens." I wrote it actually originally for a bar mitzvah and then rewrote it in a smaller form in the Jewish news. And then they wanted it in a larger form, so reinserted portions of it for the Jewish news here. So it's been printed before here. But this is the original version. Among the Torah's most vivid descriptions of prophecy is the detailed imagery of Yaakov Avinu's dream, recounted at the outset of this week's parsha, talking about Jacob. We are told of a ladder standing firmly on the ground whose head reaches the heavens as malachim, angels of Hashem, ascend and descend upon it. There on the ladder, Hashem identifies himself to Yaakov and blesses him with the promise of safe return and the promise of a multitude of progeny who will inherit the land. No less stirring than the image and words of the Almighty are the words of Yaakov himself when he awakens. Surely Hashem is present in this place, and I did not know. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. One must ask, how could Yaakov Avinu have said such apparently blasphemous words? Was this student of Avraham and Yitzchak not aware of the most basic of all Jewish principles, that Hashem is everywhere? Parenthetically, did he not ever hear the song by Uncle Maishi?
Okay. Hashem is here.
Exactly. So what is meant when the Bechir Sheba'avos, the most complete of the forefathers, states, Hashem is present in this place and I did not know? What did Yaakov see that made him change his perspective, and what was his initial viewpoint, and his new conclusion? In the end of Parshas Toldos, the Torah teaches us that Yaakov is sent away by his parents for two purposes: to flee from his brother Esav and to begin building his family by finding a wife in Haran. A careful reading of the verses and the words of our sages yield that on his way to the house of his uncle Lavan, Yaakov dedicated himself to uninterrupted Torah study for 14 years in the yeshiva of Shem and Aver. In the second verse of this week's Parsha, we are told, again, by the way, Vayetzeh is immediately after Toldos, so this takes place right after what I just described of him fleeing. Vayifga b'makom vayelen sham. Translated literally, Yaakov came into contact with the place and lay down there. The Midrash Breishis Rabbah teaches that Yaakov wanted to pass that place, but the entire world stood up like a wall in his way. In that place he fell asleep, and in that place he dreamt of Hashem's blessings and proclaimed Hashem's presence. Through understanding the Torah's description of his arrival there as a barrier of the entire world, we can reach a deep understanding of Yaakov's statements and of the entire nature of our purpose and path. The great Slonim Rebbe, known as the Nesiva Shalom, on pages 189 and 193 in the book on Bereishis, explains that Yaakov arrived at that place at the age of 77, having dedicated his entire life to Torah study and performance of mitzvos. As we know, the Torah describes him in Parshas Toldos as Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim, a wholesome man abiding in the tents of Torah study. Through nearly 40 years, he had no engagement with the material world he was now entering. He had lived a life of total Kedusha and Tahara, sanctity and purity, removed from this worldly concerns. But now Yaakov was commanded to leave the study hall and to build a family. Now Yaakov was to enter a world of new challenges and of physicality in its ultimate sense. This is the intent of the Midrash when it states that the world presented itself like a wall in his way. Now at the age of 77, Yaakov was leaving the lofty and descending into what he perceived as a lowly place. In that place he dreamt, there, as he was leaving the pristine safety of the Beis Medrash and going to search for a physical and spiritual mate, he saw a true vision of the world's nature. Hashem granted him the clarity to know that the world is a ladder, a place of junction between heaven and earth. The path of a Jew and the reality of man is that he resides not only in a heavenly abode, but in a constant connection to a ladder that while reaching heaven, its foot stands solidly on earth. Yaakov saw that a perception that God does not exist in the lowly place of earthly sustenance or physical intimacy is most definitely a misperception. In that place, he could now properly proclaim, surely Hashem is present in this place, and I didn't know. How awesome is the place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. The Ramban, Nachmanides, in his introduction to the book of Shemos, teaches that the actions of our forefathers are a sign for their children. The purpose of the historical reports of the episodes of their lives is to teach us, their children, eternal lessons for life. Through his prophetic dream, Yaakov realized that the path to Hashem is not disrupted by the physical elements of this world, but rather that engagement in the physical for exclusively holy purpose is the very gate of the heavens. This has been true for mankind in every generation. The Ramban in his Igeres HaKodesh writes that physical involvement carried out with perfect adherence to halacha and proper intent merits the distinction of Kodesh HaKodeshim, the Holy of Holies. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato echoes this notion in Mesilas Yesharim, the Path of the Just, with the words, a person who is sanctified through the holiness of his creator, even his physical deeds truly become matters of holiness. One who has attained holiness and who cleaves to his God constantly and whose soul walks about immersed in thought regarding those matters that are of a transcendent nature in his love for his creator and his fear of him is considered as if he were walking about before the eternal in the land of the living while still in this world. And this kind of person is likened to the tabernacle, the Beis HaMikdash, and the altar. Rabbi Feldman, Yibodol L'chaim Tovim, that means that he should live and be well till a long time, even though we just mentioned people who had already passed away, summarizes the entire concept in his On Judaism, page 118. Paradoxically, there is only one gate through which the spiritual arrives at its realization, the gate of the material. In our own lives as parents, wage earners, and consumers, we have an infinite number of contact points with Hashem. In every element of every day of our lives, we can stand in the awareness that this place is the gate of the heavens. We can touch the eternal and the transcendent in a well-cooked meal or a well-eaten one, in an honest day of work, and in an honest and disciplined purchase of our needs. We stand at the height of the world when we bathe our children, drive them to school and appointments, and beautify our homes. We mustn't misperceive the reality of this world. How awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and this is the gate of the heavens. Okay. Have a good night, everybody. So, this is the whole story. Like, this is the whole story. And it's so fundamental to Jewish life that it impacts everything about the worldview of the Jews, as opposed to the worldview of the other religious movements in the world. I once saw a sort of documentary that made the point that every other major world religion, in some way or another, teaches not only generally asceticism, if that's the right pronunciation of the word, but also it even teaches celibacy as an ideal for its truly religious, great ones. Now, we know that about Catholicism, right? And if there are the other derivatives of Christianity, we don't need to argue. They could have their own reasons why they don't teach that, or they do, or whatever it may be. But they definitely teach a certain doctrine of physicality is dirty. Spirituality is an absence, is a distance from physicality. Buddhism, for sure. I actually just asked this of a Buddhist driver I had. I was in a Uber. It wasn't you.
No, it definitely wasn't.
Yeah. I was in an Uber, and we were talking about things, and I asked him about this, and he said, "Yeah, of course, that's, you know, the monks are not allowed." And it's true about Islam in certain more serious strings. I saw this maybe 15 years ago, so I don't remember all the details. On and on, Hindu, for sure, it's true. On and on. Now, of course, in Judaism, it's not true. In fact, the Kohen Gadol must be married or he's disqualified from the service of the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur. So much so that he has a second wife already designated should his wife pass away before, just moments before Yom Kippur. Okay? Must be married.
Can he marry a widow?
The Kohen Gadol may not.
Yeah.
But that's not consequential.
Oh, okay.
What does it matter? The woman who's reserved is not a widow.
No.
Okay. So anyway, the point is, though, that this is fundamentally different for our worldview, and it's so profoundly important. Its relevance in Jewish life is at every single moment of Jewish life. For example, one would think the holier the time, the more withdrawn from physicality you should be, because after all, it's a holy time. But with the exception of Yom Kippur, which is not the holiest day of the year, I'll come back to that in a second. Okay, with the exception of Yom Kippur, every Jewish holiday requires eating. You're not even allowed to fast. Think about that as a worldview. We're going to have a rendezvous with God, a moment of increased spirit. So you would think, naturally, a person by their Western bias would imagine that means more prayer, more meditation, more whatever, and less food and other physical pleasures, when in fact the exact opposite is true. Now, why is that the case? There's more than one answer to that. A question? Question? No? Wait?
We're fine.
Excellent. So why is that true? Because paradoxically, there is only one gate through which the spiritual arrives at its realization, the gate of the material. Anybody could be ascetic, removed. The Ribbono Shel Olam did not create a world so that the enemy is right here and delicious. In other words, it's delicious, but it's the enemy. It's disgusting. It's dirty. Now, that doesn't make sense. Actually, the least sensible thing I know in religious life, other than some of the revelation stories maybe, the least sensible thing is, do not engage in physical pleasures, but heaven is filled with physical pleasures. That's the silliest thing in the whole world. In other words, that's the message of some religions. After you die, especially if you give it your life for religion, you get 70 of the most desirable things in the world. Meshuggah and Ganson. It's crazy. If you believe that God hates you, then you'll construct a religion like that. Okay?
Is that the version?
Yeah.
The 72 version.
Yeah. So in other words, you think that God hates you. The real ultimate pleasure you could possibly have is that, but you're not allowed it. It's silliness. The ultimate pleasure that you could have is ruchnius, is spirituality, is closeness to Hashem, is cleaving to God. That's the only real pleasure there is in the world, ultimately. It's mostly, its domain is the next world. However, it's available in this world also, as everyone has felt, in different moments of transcendent pleasure. How many steaks would you trade in for your, for nachis from your grandchildren? You know, Would you rather have your grandsons putting on tefillin on the first day or 10,000 steaks? Right. How about pizza? All right. See, no. Right, of course. I mean, and that's one example of transcendent pleasure. The truth is that the more engaged a person is in the observance of the mitzvos and in their mission of their life being spiritual matters, the more you can feel these pleasures all the time. All the time. In a well-formed lesson plan that touches people's lives and increases their ability to be good and be accomplishing things. To sacrifice to go and be there for people is a sense of tremendous mission and transcendent pleasure. And that's what the world of the spirit is like. The vehicles of that spirit is not the removal of the physical, but the utilization of the physical as soldiers in the army of the soul. The soul is the general, and Hashem commanded you, Anshei Kodesh Tehiyun Li, be for me holy people. I think the rabbi describes this in this chapter. Anshei Kodesh Tehiyun Li means do not be angels, about whom the Talmud says in Chagiga that they're totally removed from the physical. Do not be animals, about whom the Talmud says they're totally removed from the spiritual. Be people who are, as we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, I think it was maybe three, who stand in that balance of either descending to be like the ground, Adam from the root Adama, or ascending to be like the spiritual, like God, Adam from the language of Adamel Elyon. I'll be similar to the lofty one. So we are the people of choice. We're a people that chooses, meaning human beings are. And human beings can take the physical and lift it up with them, or they can be servants to the physical. So taking the physical and lifting it up with you is enjoying the physical in the context of marriage, in the context of giving and love and togetherness and bonding. Every other discussion of that same activity is all about self-serving decadence that derails a person from being anything. It's just a behemoth. It's just an animal. Right? And the same thing with food. The same thing with food. The truth is it feels great to eat food responsibly. It's a great feeling. You realize it's just fuel. It's just fuel. So you fuel up, get back to business. We spoke about that this past Shabbos. That the pasuk, the verse says in Shema, that if you do what Hashem wants, so the reward will be, v'nasati esav besod chalivim techa ve'achalta v'savata. I will give grass in the field for your animals, the understanding is to eat, and you will eat and be satisfied or sated. So I heard from my teacher, Rabbi Yosef Tendler, who said it in the name of Rabbi Avram Pam, that the verse God does not bless the animals with satisfaction. It doesn't say your animal will have grass in the field to eat and be satisfied, and you will eat and be satisfied. It just says it'll have grass, but the person has to be satisfied. Why? Because if the animal will spend its whole life eating, so what? Good. It's a fine life for an animal to sit and graze the whole life. What's it got to get onto anyway? Its purpose is either to give milk or to get plump and be shechted or to schlep things or whatever it may be. That's what its purpose is. So it won't be satisfied. So what? But if a person will be cursed with all the money in the world to constantly have everything it could consume, but never have the blessing of satisfaction, entire lives are wasted that way. There's no purpose in living for that. It's just a waste of time. Might as well not be hungry so that you can eat, so that you can eat more. Might as well just be expired.
Don't pour for the soup.
Right. Don't scorn the soup. I said that on Shabbos. Right, exactly. No, scorn the soup, right? Don't go for the soup, right? As you said. Okay, so the point is, that's what Kedusha is. Kedusha, therefore, getting back to the holidays, eating beautiful foods, L'chavad Shabbos, like the Gemara describes about Hillel and Shammai, they had a little bit of an argument whether you should say, one would, I don't remember the exact language, but They would see something delicious on a Monday, buy it L'chavad Shabbos, on our Shabbos, and then, I forgot what the argument is, but I think it's Shammai who would then, if he saw something Tuesday, would say, I don't have enough for Shabbos, buy something better on Tuesday, and then consume what was thought to be better for Shabbos, and leave the best for Shabbos. Clothing, food, spirituality, getting in touch with Hashem through food. Now here's really a big idea. I think the rabbi opens the whole thing with, you want to talk about something really deep today. Here's something really deep. The 13th of the Rambam's principles of Jewish faith that define Judaism, and no other group of thoughts can be called Judaism. Only these 13 things can honestly be called what the Jews have been taught by God at Sinai to believe. So among them are things like God exists, and there's prophecy, and reward and punishment, and so on. The most famous by far is number 12. I believe with a full faith in the coming of the Mashiach, and even though it shall wait, I wait for it every day. That's the most well-known. Every song about Ani Mamin basically is that one, except for one, which is about the first one, sung by Dvekas. Now, the 13th, the one after that, is I believe with a complete faith in reincarnation. Now, that word alone evokes non-Jewish thoughts right away. That we're victims of language, Western biases, that's life. But we believe in Tchias HaMesim, that people will again be alive, even though they died. That's obvious to anybody who's ever read a single Shemoneh Esrei, if you've ever davened once. So right away, God is referred to as Mechaye Mesim, the one who will bring life to those who are dead. We believe that. I once heard from my wife's other grandfather, Rosh Hashiva of Yaakov Weinberg. I think it's on a recording. I'm certain it's on a recording, which means it's available somewhere out there. And I probably have it. He talked about what will happen at the end of time. And he said, you understand why it's heresy to believe that there will not be reincarnation. That's the way he used to speak. You understand why. Like, as if, you know, Rebbe, I have no idea what you're going to say, but, you know. So, yeah, I hope I say this right. So there's a lot of things the Jews believe. Why is this one of the 13 things that if you don't believe this, then you don't believe that, you don't believe in Yiddishkeit? None of them says on it, if you believe that Shabbos is on Sunday, not on Saturday, that's not in the book. That's not among the 13 things. So this 13th thing is, you have to believe in reincarnation, that people will come back from the dead. Now, everybody at this table knows that no one ever talks about that. Okay, you can go 12 years to Jewish day school, they never spoke about it once, probably. And nobody talks about that, because nobody has a good grasp of what that means. And neither do I. I'll tell you straight up, I don't know whether you come back primarily as your grandfather's grandson, or your grandson's grandfather. I have no idea. Okay? I don't know. How do you manage all the relationships? I got no idea. Okay? You know, Zadie, what do you say? I don't know. Ask Zadie. You know? So I don't know how it works. At all. And there's lots of other questions people ask. What age? Which marriage? I got no idea. Okay? Yeah. I have no idea. Which incarnation of my soul? I don't know. Okay. But why by force must there be Tchias HaMesim, reincarnation? It says as follows. And whatever, don't, I could be saying his language wrong, so don't say I heard that he said exactly this way. Because this is obviously a big esoteric idea. He says like this. Most people believe that you are your soul. We've taught this from when we're kids. You are your soul. Your body is kind of like clothing that animates the soul. But you really are your soul. That resonates with most. Think like that. He says like this. The purpose of a well-lived life is what we're describing here tonight. The merger of the spirituality and the physicality into one well-orchestrated army of accomplishment in which the soul directs the body. But as we said from the path of the just, a person who is sanctified through the holiness of his creator, even if even his physical deeds truly become matters of holiness, one who has attained holiness and who cleaves to his God constantly and whose soul walks about immersed in thought regarding those matters that are of transcendent nature in his love for his creator and his fear of him, is considered as if he were walking about before the eternal in the land of the living, the world to come, while still in this world. And this kind of person is likened to the tabernacle, the Beis HaMikdash, and the altar. There are leaders in the middle of this where I skipped some words. In those leaders, he says that a person is capable of eating a regular meal on a regular day as if he was the Kohen Gadol eating from the altar in the Beis HaMikdash. Sanctified food. What makes the food sanctified? The fact that you have, that it's very carefully adherent to the laws, that it's being eaten not for personal pleasure, but for nourishment so that one can serve God, that it is prepared without argument, and so on and so forth. The main thing is that holiness, when it's really realized, is when one is doing what that which is permitted in a fully intentional way. In other words, there, one can be distant from holiness even when doing things that are permitted. I'll come back to that. But if someone is realized their whole actuality of how life is supposed to be lived, there's a complete merger of spirituality and physicality. Not that he is a pure one who's distant from physicality. This person is serving God fully, not only at davening and learning, but at the dining room table and in the bedroom. Fully serving Hashem. Totally engaged in the physical, at the store when shopping, et cetera, in every physical activity. That's the goal of a fully realized religious life in Jewish worldview. We can see how that's different from the other nations. That's a Jewish worldview. Says the Rosh Hashiva. How could it possibly be then that if that's the goal, to engage the physicality, not distance the physicality, how could it possibly be then that the end experience of the whole thing, when you finally get where you're supposed to go perfectly, is the removal of the body? The removal of the body is a way station, a cleansing place. We all make mistakes. The soul departs from the body, and we all make mistakes, and there's a cleansing in the world of the souls. But by force, if the body-soul merger is ideal, not second rate, by force, we believe that people will come back from the dead and merge again after the cleansing into a perfect merger of body and soul. He holds that reincarnation, Tchiyas HaMesim, is logic and Jewish perspective obligates us to see it that way because we're not spiritual beings, aphysical. Sanctity means a perfect merger. And therefore, the perfect picture includes the body. Okay, that's a big idea. Questions? Arguments? Tomatoes?
Are you saying that when someone passes away, their soul goes up to the Olam HaBod and it gets cleansed, and then it may seem it comes back and meets and joins with the body? Is that what you're
saying? There's nothing controversial about that statement at all. Yeah, definitely. Yes. Yeah. I would only argue that the term Olam Haba might be not correct in there. In other words, there's other terms that more precise sort of technicians of the area of this thing, which I am not. Olam HaNeshamos, for example, the Rosh Chaim Lutzata uses in the end chapters of the path of the way of God, etc. Olam Haba might be a precursor in this world to the Tchiyas HaMesim. But I want to say something very important, which I also do not know the answer to. You realize that time is a physical thing. In other words, Einstein proved that time is connected to matter. So if time is a physical thing, it's very hard to speak about waiting in the world of the souls. Now, that's way beyond the human mind to grasp. Because, of course, when you discuss God himself, there can be no before and after, because time is itself a creation. And so we lose our bearings completely, and so we just do our best. Right? So I'm not sure, after one passes away, how the whole time thing plays out. Just don't know. Just don't know.
But then why do we have a time constraint with Shiva and the amount of months that you wait supposedly to let the soul not be earthbound anymore? That's very time
constraint. You're 100% right. You're 100% right. And that is a case for the other side of the question, which is why I said I'm not sure about the whole picture. You're 100% right. It's definitely something more than just the catharsis of humans. In other words, some things are just personally cathartic, so people do them, right? And that's a whole discussion for another time, you know. But that is not just cathartic. It is definitely reflects realities of soul stages and cleansing stages and the like. So you're definitely onto something. Don't know how it works. That's the real truth. And nobody has been there to come back and tell you.
Right.
Yeah. Nobody speaks from experience.
Yeah. So this whole thing about you say God is 11 months, not 12 months, because he's saying for 12 months the person's a Rasha, not a good person, he's saying for 11 months.
Yeah, same thing as what Mrs. Nashman is saying. I can't call her by her first name. She's a teacher. Yeah. Exactly. That's the same notion. Right.
You know, it's interesting because in Israel, when someone passes away, you lay the stone within 1 month after they pass away. Here in the United States, it's 11 months.
Yeah, I want to tell you that you could tell me differently because you all have more experience than I do. I have found no custom more varying than that. I can't get a handle on, is it really 11 months? Because some people do it.
No.
Basically, it's more than half a year. Yeah. That's basically my...
Well, it could be any time.
It ends up that way, exactly. And I'm not sure.
I have to
spend more time looking into that from like a halachic perspective, what the real timing is supposed to be. But you're right. What you said is 100% right. And it's a very important point, which has to do with, and I feel like we spoke about this maybe at this class or something else. It has to do with soul realities. My Rebbe Zichrono Livracha, Rebbe Eugent, he told us under no circumstances would he visit a grave in the first year outside the land of Israel. Now, I don't know about loved ones. Again, catharsis. I'm not getting into that. Okay, maybe it's different. I'm not commenting on that. This is what he said. Because the soul is still hovering and there's confusion for the soul when it's connected to this world and whatever it is. But he said, if I remember correctly, that had to do with in this world, outside the land of Israel, as opposed to into. So not one of you can see the waves of that, you know, unless you know something I don't know. We don't see that with those waves. We have to trust.
But he was also very mystical and
spiritual. He saw the waves more.
He said, there's something about this man. He was a Holocaust survivor, and he was a teacher at the school that our kids went to. And he was like a very small man, but he was huge. And everybody that had him loved him, and I shouldn't say everybody.
That's
there were
not true,
some yeah. people that did not love him.
That's correct.
But the majority of the people that we knew loved him because he had a certain spirituality to him, and there was something mystical about him. Because our kids used to say,
it's very hard for me to talk about.
Mystical, literally. And he did wonderful things. He started that Kollel program. I mean, he did things at Ida Crown that were
anybody who davens here regularly. I mean, I speak about him constantly. Most important, impactful person in my life growing up, you know, later on. Yeah,
Couldn't be an answer to Mrs. Nashband's comment.
You don't have to call me that. I didn't teach you. or
me, but two of my kids.
Yeah, but two of the kids.
Limit the amount of time that we grieve in order to be able to get back to leading a holy life, because if you grieve too long, too much, involve yourself in it too much, the sadness overwhelms you, and then you can't move forward and lead the life that you're telling us we should lead.
Yeah, so the answer is, of course, yes. Whether that's a byproduct or the primary reason, I'm not sure. What you said is true. Right. But what you said makes me think about something else, which is in the book Chovos Halavavos, Duties of the Heart by Bachya Ibn Bakuta, like it's a 1,000 years old, the book. He writes about the gift of what's that? Rabbeinu Bachya. Okay, he was the author of the Chovos Halavavos. So he writes there about the gift of forgetting. Now, people don't like the word forgetting because forgetting? One second. If you would live in the pain of the moment, of any one of the moments, you would just be broken. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you a blessing of removal of that pain, and that's a bracha to live life, right? No doubt about it. Doesn't mean the pain goes away fully, and it can't, right? And the truth is that especially when it comes to people who lose children, I once heard from a cousin of mine who lost two children that the Gemara says describing, I guess, a financial matter, if I remember correctly. The Gemara says, Bra Kara Davua, a son is the foot of his father. It's talking about an intimate relationship that makes it be like he represents him, something like that. So he said that when you have any other loss, then it's not the implication of that Gemara is that there's a piece of you. It's your leg, right? So there's a merger between heaven and earth like that that's uncommon to any other thing because you have a foot in the next world. And that obviously that bridge is not meant to go away because it's a piece of you. It's not meant to go away. But nevertheless, the customs are they're strong to give you the strength to get on right with the matters that are at hand, which is the rest of life, right? No doubt about it. So yeah, there are big things here. They're very big things being described here. But the foundational concept that we're talking about is that a person is supposed to engage the physical in the permitted ways. Now, I think I said I would get back to this concept. There's a verse in the Torah. It's the first pasuk in Vayikra 19. It's the opening words of, actually it's the second verse. It's the opening words of Parshas Kedoshim. It says, Kedoshim tiyu, ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. You shall be holy, because God, am holy. So this comes right after the Torah describes all the prohibited physical relations. Incest and other such things. Right after that chapter, it says, Kedoshim to you, you should be holy. So Rashi, in his commentary there, says, essentially the central question that Rashi and Nachmanides, the Ramban, are dealing with is, what is meant by be holy? In other words, is it just hyperbole, just some kind of like rah-rah statement, like, be holy, but it doesn't have an actual implication. Like if the Torah did not have these words, didn't include this command, would you still have the whole Torah? What's being commanded by this be holy? So Rashi takes one approach and Ramban takes another. Both are incredibly important. Rashi says that the Torah just recorded. Rashi in very many places connects what had just been mentioned to what's being mentioned. Okay, so for example, the discussion of the spies who speak badly about the land of Israel is immediately after in the Torah, the discussion of Miriam speaking badly about Moshe. Comes Rashi and says the reason that they're juxtaposed is to tell you they should have learned a lesson from seeing Miriam punished for speaking ill and they shouldn't have spoken ill. And so on and so forth. There's 100 examples of this. Not 100, that's an exaggeration, but there's a lot. So Rashi is dealing with this and says like this. He says, the Torah says you're not allowed to have the following physical sexual relations. And then says, Kedoshim tiyu, which means, Prushim tiyu, be distant. get very far away from those things. And the sages say elsewhere, "Bechol makom sha'ata motzei geder erva sham ata motzei kedusha." Wherever you find, and I don't remember what the source of this is, maybe it's a later source, not the sages, but I think it's the sages. In any place where you find a fence against forbidden relations, there you find sanctity. In other words, it's sanctified to distance the genders in such a way where it doesn't lead to the wrong thing. Take the brilliance of the mitzvah, or the rabbinic ordinances called yichud. Yichud is the prohibition of seclusion. It has a lot of rules. Not allowed, one man, one woman, and in some cases more than one of each, are not allowed to be secluded in one place together. I mean, we shouldn't know from it, and I shouldn't know anything about this. But every single story that is about people going the wrong way, cheating, making mistakes, whatever it is always begins with seclusion. It's working late, etc. Lo Elena, we shouldn't know from it. Sickening things. Every one of these things begins with seclusion, every one of them. So it's so obvious that there should be a mitzvah of yichud that it shouldn't be allowed to be secluded in one place. So obvious. So that's holy. The Torah itself does not prohibit yichud, seclusion. Come the rabbis and say, this is a logical fence. This has to be this way. So wherever you find something like that, says Rashi, Shamata Motza Kedusha, Rashi doesn't say it exactly this, but that's what sanctity is. In fact, by the way, the term Kedoshim always is found by either food, physical intimacy, or clothing in the Torah. By tzitzis, which is an example of clothing, it's near shatnez. The whole beginning of the food discussion about what animals are kosher and what are not begins with be holy and ends with be holy. The whole discussion of the forbidden relations begins with be holy, ends with be holy. Then you come into this be holy as a general principle, comes Rashi and says, be distant, be separate. Make walls, make fences. Torah is obligating you like that. In that realm. Good, that's Rashi. The Ramban says something different and fantastic. I don't know, this also had a very big impact on me. I'll never forget the words, and I learned them in elementary school. The Ramban says that it is possible for a person to do all kinds of things that are permitted and become a degraded, decadent, there's a good word for it. In Hebrew, it's called a naval. Naval b'rishus ha-Torah. Quote unquote, within the permission of the Torah, the person can become a debased person. But there's one single word for this. Can't think of. How does that happen? It happens like this. Let's take food as only one example. A person indulges every single pleasure he wants or she wants. Constant indulgence, but it's all glatt kosher. It's all glatt. It's all the finest chassidus shechita. Okay? It's separate milchig kitchen from a fleisha kitchen. It's all separate. It's all kosher. Kosher l'mahadrin. Right? But kosher l'mahadrin, there is a problem if somebody, let's say, would go out for dinner every night to a restaurant that costs $2.50 a night per meal. You would say that, and then in America they say, but I can afford it. Right? Or I have enough credit. I have a large enough credit limit. I can't afford it, but I have a large enough credit limit. So comes the Torah and says, it's not, first of all, everyone knows it's a bad decision, even if you have enough credit. Right? Then, is it a bad decision if you can afford it? And it's healthy? It's not, how low in cholesterol? Right? What has become of this person when they indulge? It's an indulgent monster. He's a glutton. Yeah. Say again? Gluttony would be, the Hebrew term for it is not as clean as gluttony. Achila gasa, you would say. Like, he just is an overeater. In other words, like you sit there and it's like a gasut, maybe, right? He's a chazer. Yeah. He's a chazer, but everything's kosher. And he's still a chazer.
He's a kosher chazer.
Exactly. Right. And by the way, there's a term in Yiddish, which means when somebody wants to say it looks kosher, even though it isn't kosher. So there's a term called chazer fiesel. Okay? Kasher means pig's feet. Okay? Why? Because the pig's feet are have split hooves, but he doesn't chew his cud. So he just shows you his feet. Look, I'm kosher. Right? So it's the same thing. He's a novel b'rishus haTorah. He is a degraded, decadent glutton. But it's permitted. And I can give you examples that I don't want to describe in the realm of physical intimacy, the same exact thing. He might argue, you know, after all, whatever, I'm not going to go into that. You can use your own imagination. You get it. Comes Kedoshim to you and says, you're not allowed to be a monster, even if it has the best hechsher. Okay? That's the bottom line. You're not allowed to. You're going to go to Shemayim and you're going to say, you know, but they advertised for it in the frum papers. Right? You know how many the really holy people can't stand the advertising that goes on in the frum world, including the author of this book? You know, when you see that he wrote a great article, you can find it probably somewhere. It was very recently in Mishpacha magazine. There was an article about Shavuos. It was an ad, And he wrote, and the ad was something like, you may have to stay up all night, but you can have cheesecake. Or something like that. And it was an ad for, even though in the wilderness they didn't have such good food, now when you recreate the wilderness, you can have, you know, there's nine varieties of the cheesecake. Or something like that. So Zadie wrote an article about this topic. Right? That's not what Torah was here to teach you. To say, you know, and it's hard because it makes money and whatever. And there's an amazing thing, which is, this is a totally separate topic for another time, that in the time when Newsweek has closed and U.S. News has closed and New Orleans no longer has a daily newspaper, etc., and print journalism is at an all-time low, historic low, print journalism in the firm world is at an all-time high, okay, yeah, for sure. Yated and Jewish Press and Hamudia and Mishpacha and Zman and Ami, and that's not even getting into the Chassidish papers and stuff like that. Okay, and they're bigger than ever, which is itself a tremendous tribute to Shabbos. That's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. It's the reality of Shabbos is what makes that happen. But they're filled with ads that make people who are sensitive to these things uncomfortable.
Okay.
Yeah, same thing. Same thing, right? Somewhere buried down below is the spiritual benefits, and the top 10 points are the physical benefits. And it's challenging. It doesn't make everything prohibited. I want to be very clear about this. This is an incredibly important thing. You can have all those delights when it's for the purpose of recreation, rejuvenation, to get back to the business of life. It's possible. You know, I went to such a Pesach program. It was the most rejuvenating time of my whole life. It was, I really mean it. It was an incredibly stressful, difficult time in life. And we went away, and we went together with my whole family. I can tell you this. We went out of the country. It was a very expensive undertaking, not paid for by me, thank God. Okay. But the point is, the fact that we went out of the country made my phone ring over a 14-day period exactly zero times. Okay, that was great. That was great for my kids. That was great for my family. That was great. Right? So there's roles for these things. I usually go away on vacation after a Simchas Torah. Not usually, always. Every single year, the last 7 or 8 years. I go away for a couple of days on vacation. It motivates me to do everything I can in serving Hashem and serving the community all the way through to the final bell of Simchas Torah, knowing I can relax after for a couple of days. That's good. That's healthy. Eating great Shabbos meals together with family, you know, being together with your family, doing things that elevate your spirit, giving yourself nourishment and strength to be great. It's extraordinary. It's the most important thing. And in fact, it's eating from the Mizbeach. It's being like Kohen Gadol when you do it for that purpose. That's what sanctity is. And that's a great surprise to most people, that sanctity is only found in the lifting up of the physical, not in the avoidance of the physical. Now, are there a lot of rules? Sure, there's a lot of rules. In fact, there are more rules the more dangerous and tempting the pleasure. Chazal made lots of rules surrounding, you know, there's a lot of fences around the Torah. Oh, maybe this is a good time to talk about fences around the Torah. It's a little late. We'll do that a different time. But Chazal made a lot of fences around the Torah. The rabbis made a lot of fences around the Torah, as the Torah commands them to. If you pay close attention, there are three areas where the fences are most profound. The laws of Shabbos, the laws of Kashrus, and the laws of sexuality. Those are the three areas where there are the most fences. So Shabbos is a different realm, except for the fact that a person is very tempted to believe that they created the world, they run the whole world, all of their success is dependent on them. But it's also because it's the very defining reality of Jewish people. But the fact that in the realm of food and sex, there are a lot of rules, is extremely logical, unbelievably logical. And what's with all the rules? Well, the thing is like this. A person, if he is to engage in these physical things, or she, is at all times at risk of becoming an animal, of chasing these things only for their own pleasures, at all times. Really, that's a risk to all of us. The ultimate goal of the Torah is that you become an angelic-type person who merges all this. So the Torah does not say, as Western society says very often, if you want it and you're not damaging anybody else, then it's good for you. Right? That's the basis of some of the changes in Western philosophies over the last 15 years, is that I can prove that enough people desire this. Well, I can prove that enough people desire cheating on their spouse. Is it a good thing? Ridiculous. It's a ridiculous premise that if I can prove that enough people desire it, then it's good. Most ridiculous premise ever. So the Torah gets the fact, Hashem gets the fact that he created you and you want stuff. But he wants you to use that stuff in the holy way. So therefore, there's all kinds of rules. There's things that are never allowed. There's things that are sometimes not allowed. There's things that are only allowed in this way and not in that way. And that's to get you to these goals that we've been describing of being at the gate of heaven all the time. So I once heard something, this goes back 15 years ago, from Rebbetzin Tursky, Rebbetzin Fagi Tursky, who is together with her husband, has been at the helm of the Milwaukee Jewish community for a long time, or at least that part, the Sherman Park, Milwaukee community, Rabbi Michal Tursky's wife. She said that life is like violin strings. You see violin strings sitting on a table, just the strings. They're free to do whatever they want. They're not bound to anything. You can shake them this way, shake them that way, turn them this way, turn them that way, tie them, untie them, whatever you want, they're free. But they're not free to make the music that they were intended to make until you tie them down completely, taut to the violin. So is life, that when we theoretically want to be free to do whatever we want, you're free to do everything except to make the music that your life was intended for. For that, you need the Eitz Chaim Hilamach Hazikimba. You need the tree of life, which is sustaining for those who tie themselves to it, who are bound to it. And that's what it means. We should have mentioned this last week, that the one who studies Torah is free. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, there's no free person like the one who's engaged in Torah. Because we're all servants to something. Right? Fashion is such a perfect example of it. This is in and this is not in. But it's going to be in 4 years. Unbelievable.
It'll come back in 4 years.
Exactly. Fascinating. Fascinating. So we're just servants. All of us, everybody, not me, all, the whims of society and whatever it is. You see this with the avant-garde liberal Jewish writers who are always saying that, you know, always changing their mores and whatever it is. They're just worshiping some new more that somebody else is dictating. So everybody's a servant. Only when you're a servant of Hashem can you make the music of life. And I remember my teacher, Rabbi Lipman Podolsky, who passed away at a very young age. He was my teacher in Israel. He was describing about how they told me life was going to be hard if I became more religious. And I told him it was going to be good. And then he screams and he goes, "Don't I look like I'm having fun?" You know? And the truth is that it's very extraordinarily rewarding to live a life of discipline. To live a life of hefkerus, of ownerlessness, is ultimately just leads people off the edge. And I could go on and on and on about this because there's, and I will, but just not tonight, you know, because there are so many examples of this. When the person who has saras, which is somewhat incorrectly translated as leprosy, when he's purified, so it says that one bird is slaughtered. They bring two birds, and one bird is flown away. So Rav Hirsch says that the one that's slaughtered, the one that's flown away, looks at the other one and says, he was killed. But what happens to the one that flows away? Nothing. The one who was slaughtered is brought onto the Mizbeach. Same thing on Yom Kippur. You have the two goats. They're there, both at the doorstep of their realizing their potential. Nothing could happen better to a goat than being the korban that all of Klal Yisrael receives its atonement based on. And one goes, loser. His throat is slaughtered, and he is dead, and I'm free. Until you're thrown off a cliff, and you're nothing. Right? So that's world history too. That's life. That's Jewish life. That's a future of good character and good deeds and good life and progeny and spiritual progeny, the people that we help, and on and on and on. Because discipline leads to happiness and success. Decadence and giving into every temptation leads to nothing.
Empty pleasures.
Yes. And later on in life, really nothing. You know? Nothing. I wasn't going to say this, but I have a lot of respect for these recent football players who are retiring. I don't know if you follow that story. Lots of football players are retiring very young now. One guy in San Francisco, he played one season, announces his retirement. Mm-hmm. He realizes, I don't want to be dead or broken for my whole life.
Very broken.
You know? Exactly. You know, do you know what the average life expectancy of an NFL football player is? 54 years. Okay? The average male life expectancy in America is like 77 years, something like that. 54 if you play in the NFL. Bad decision. But a lot of money and a lot of fame.
Yeah, this guy left $10 million on the table.
Yeah, one after the other. There's so many of them. There were like six or eight players that retired this year out of the realization, it's not in my interest. Okay, anyway, in spiritual things, it's also not in your interest just to live ownerless. Okay, any last comments or questions? All right, let's stop here.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.